rails against the West in a video message on opening day of the BRICS summit.
Putin will participate via video call after his trip was complicated by an international criminal court arrest warrant issued for him in March.
Plus, one of 18 co-defendants in a plot to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election loss in Georgia is defiant as he turns himself in for booking.
The attempt to criminalize our rights to such redress with this indictment will have and is already having profound consequences for our system of justice.
And a movie producer talks about what went into making his internationally acclaimed documentary on the democracy movement in Hong Kong. Today is Wednesday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa hosted his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping for an official state visit full of pomp and ceremony on the sidelines of the BRICS summit of emerging nations on Tuesday. Xi was greeted in Pretoria with a 21-gun salute as the two countries marked 25 years of diplomatic relations. Kate Bartlett has more from Johannesburg.
Ramaphosa welcomed Xi warmly, recalling how Beijing supported South Africa's struggle against apartheid and calling the relationship between the two a very special one. He noted that China is South Africa's biggest global trade partner with some $32 billion in bilateral trade last year, but stressed a trade imbalance in China's favor needs addressing.
As South Africa, we would like to see the significant trade deficit narrowed, and this visit is an opportunity for us to look at ways to do so.
South Africa is currently in the throes of a major energy crisis, with its economy being hit hard by almost daily blackouts. Ramaphosa thanked China for donating emergency power equipment and for a grant of approximately $26 million as development assistance.
Energy cooperation with China is a recent development that we look to deepen, particularly in line with our respective commitment to low-carbon, climate-resilient development.
Ramaphosa confirmed South Africa's commitment to the One China policy and noted that Pretoria and Beijing shared a similar position in supporting the peaceful resolution of the conflict in Ukraine. For his part, Xi noted the two nations share a strong bond as comrades and brothers. Paul Nantula, a China expert at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, said while China is the world's second largest economy, it has always projected itself as a fellow developing country.
It would like Global South countries to see it as a developing country, and that becomes extremely important in terms of providing a kind of alternative counterweight to what it sees as a Western and a US-dominated international order and international system.
Several memorandums of understanding were signed during the state visit, including agreements on direct investment, the digital economy, the export of avocados, and the development of industrial parks and special economic zones. The two nations also agreed to step up cooperation on tourism and education. Later Tuesday, the BRICS Summit of Emerging Economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, gets into full swing. All the BRICS country leaders are in attendance, save for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who will be taking part remotely. Expansion of the bloc is expected to dominate the agenda of the summit, which ends Thursday. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin took multiple shots at the West on the opening day of the BRICS summit, using a pre-recorded speech that was aired on giant screens Tuesday to rail at what he called illegitimate sanctions on his country and to threaten to cut off Ukraine's grain exports permanently. Associated Press correspondent Lawrence Brooks brings us that part of the story.
Putin will participate via video call after his trip was complicated by an international criminal court arrest warrant issued for him in March over the abduction of children from Ukraine. But Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov will attend in the president's place. Lavrov's press secretary Maria Zakharova shared a video of his arrival on Telegram. Welcomed with a traditional South African dance, he stepped off the plane in Johannesburg. The bloc, consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is holding its first in-person meeting since the COVID-19 pandemic began. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
Ukraine said Tuesday its troops had entered the strategic southeastern village of Robotyne, a potentially significant advance in its counteroffensive against Russian forces. My colleague Steve Miller got an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
This is probably one of the biggest advances so far in the area of the Zaporizhzhia region, because if we look at the map, we can clearly see that actually the location of this little city is in between of the Zaporizhzhia and Melitopol. And Melitopol is considered as one of the main goals of this counter-offensive for Ukrainian forces. Of course, we don't know exactly what is the plan of the Ukrainian armed forces and Ukrainian military leadership and state leadership, but it's logical that Melitopol is one of the main goals. Butene is kind of also in the crossroads of Zaporizhzhia, Melitopol, and Mariupol. So it's not only in between of Zaporizhzhia and Melitopol, but also it's kind of this triangle of these three big cities. And of course, it's quite an advance because we also see from all the difficulties that Ukrainian armed forces are facing in this area and quite prepared defense lines of the Russian forces in this area. If we analyze all these facts, it's definitely quite an advance. And this is probably the reason why it was such a huge news and such an important for Ukraine.
And I want to also ask you about the announcement on Monday that Ukraine would continue to try and use this new corridor to ship grain on the Black Sea.
We're talking about Ukraine alternative ways. So for the moment, it looks like a temporary corridor that Ukraine is trying to realize. And we know that there are different perspectives of that and different ideas of how it can work. For now, what we know that there is this temporary corridor that already was used by one vessel. And this vessel managed to leave the port in Ukraine in Odessa and get to Istanbul. But it was only one. And for the moment, the question is if Russia will actually provide any security guarantees, either official or non-official. Also, Ukraine is considering Danube ports as a way for export and also European infrastructure by rail and road transport. So according to Ukrainian officials, Ukraine currently is exporting 2 million tons. And now with this new alternative ways, Ukraine is looking at 3 million tons and even maybe 4.5 million tons for the nearest future. So this is how it looks for the moment.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. The White House announced Tuesday that President Joe Biden will attend next month's Group of 20 summit in New Delhi, India. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said in a virtual news conference that the president and other G20 leaders will work on ways to tackle a number of important issues.
Global issues from the clean energy transition and combating climate change to mitigating the economic and social impacts of Russia's war in Ukraine to increasing the capacity of the multilateral development banks, including the World Bank, to better fight poverty and take on the significant transnational challenges that are afflicting countries across the world.
Meanwhile, Sullivan said Vice President Kamala Harris will travel to Jakarta next month to take part in the U.S.-ASEAN Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit and East Asia Summit to engage with Indo-Pacific leaders. Here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. The African Union has suspended Niger from all of its activities following the military coup there and told its members to avoid any action that might legitimize the junta. Democratic African states fear the coup will lead to expanded reach for Islamist groups and allow for a larger foothold for Russian influence in the region. Eight people, including seven children who became trapped in a disabled cable car dangling high above a valley in Pakistan, returned safely to the ground Tuesday after a daring rescue using helicopters and a makeshift chairlift. And Japan says it will start releasing into the sea this week more than 1 million metric tons of treated radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear power plant. The plan, heavily criticized by China, was approved 2 years ago by the Japanese government. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Gravitational waves are considered ripples in the fabric of space-time by the science community. The first Einstein-predicted gravitational waves were detected in 2015 by the LIGO and Virgo scientific collaborations. Scientists have now found evidence that Earth and the universe are surrounded by a background hum of ultra-low-frequency gravitational waves. The LIGO Virgo detected waves were said to oscillate at frequencies of about 100 cycles per second. By comparison, Caltech's Katerina Chatsianu says in an email that these gravitational waves oscillate once over years or decades. This discovery was based on 15 years of multiple radio telescope observations by the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. The Justice Department says a witness in the criminal case against Donald Trump over the hoarding of classified documents has retracted prior false testimony and provided new information implicating the former president. Trump is facing another prosecution alleging he tried to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. He's scheduled to turn himself in that case Thursday in Georgia. He was indicted there last week with 18 co-defendants, including Attorney John Eastman. Associated Press correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Attorney John Eastman has surrendered on charges in Donald Trump's Georgia 2020 election subversion case. The conservative attorney pushed a plan to keep Donald Trump in power. Eastman turned himself into authorities in Atlanta on charges in the Georgia case, alleging an illegal plot to overturn the former president's 2020 election loss. Eastman was booked at the Fulton County Jail. He expressed defiance.
The attempt to criminalize our rights to such redress with this indictment will have, and is already having, profound consequences for our system of justice.
Eastman was indicted last week alongside Trump and 17 others, who were accused by District Attorney Fani Willis of scheming to subvert the will of Georgia voters in a desperate bid to keep Joe Biden out of the White House. I'm Norman Hall.
And the first big event of the 2024 presidential election campaign in the United States will be held Wednesday when candidates of the Republican Party meet on a debate stage. The front runner, Donald Trump, won't be there, but is sure to be a big topic of conversation. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Milwaukee has the story.
When the Republican candidates appear on the debate stage inside a downtown Milwaukee arena Wednesday night, the overwhelming frontrunner, former President Donald Trump, says he will not be joining them. Only one of the expected participants, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, has been vociferous in criticizing Trump. Others, such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, have taken a more measured approach, hoping to convince a party base that remains loyal to Trump that they can implement the former president's right-wing Make America Great Again agenda without the legal encumbrances and other controversies. Then there's Trump's former vice president, Mike Pence, who defends his ceremonial certification of the 2020 election results, which he did against Trump's wishes. He is still in the low single digits in most polls of potential 2024 Republican voters.
Referred to my hands, if they're small, something else must be small.
Even without Trump on the debate stage making his trademark outrageous comments, the conversation will be largely about him, including the more than 90 felony charges the former president faces for alleged crimes committed before, during, and after his presidency, predicts University of Mary Washington political science professor Stephen Farnsworth.
It creates a very, very difficult environment for the other Republicans because they have their own ideas for what they want to do with respect to key issues like the economy or Ukraine or immigration, but that doesn't mean they'll have much of a chance to talk about it. They'll be asked about Donald Trump.
The debate will not be very consequential for Trump. He will still be the front runner regardless of what happens. But for the others, there could be a viral moment, good or bad, that significantly changes their polling numbers, notes American University School of International Service Provost Associate Professor Jordan Tama.
We've seen from debates in past election seasons that candidates sometimes have a moment in a debate that ends up disqualifying them because they look bad. We've also seen moments in past debates where candidates have said something that got a lot of attention for them in a positive way and gave them a huge boost.
Each candidate on Wednesday evening will be hoping their performance propels them to an encore here when the Republican Party convenes in the city to select its general election nominee in July of next year.
Steve Herman, VOA News, Milwaukee.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan says it has recorded at least 218 extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan and hundreds of other serious human rights abuses since the Taliban seized power 2 years ago. My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with VOA Islamabad correspondent Ayaz Ghul.
We know that over the past 20 years, thousands of civilians and security forces have died while the U.S. was still in Afghanistan along with NATO forces. But since the Taliban took over in August 2021, the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, has been particularly focusing on the Taliban behavior towards members of the former Afghan government that was ousted and Taliban, you know, seized power. Because Taliban, as soon as they entered the capital Kabul 2 years ago, they announced a general amnesty for all members and security forces of the ousted government. So that's what prompted the United Nations to focus on whether Taliban live up to their commitment not to target members of the former government. So this is the first report they have formally prepared and come up with documenting these hundreds of human rights violations. Obviously, UNAMA has been in the country for many, many years. So they have their people on the ground who have been conducting these research reports. And obviously in a covert manner, because Taliban are really cracking down on NGOs and foreign groups working in Afghanistan. So it's quite a credible sort of reporting that the UNAMA has done over the years. And this is also something very serious that they have now reported about how the general amnesty that the Taliban announced 2 years ago is being violated and people of the former government are being targeted and executed.
As you point out, these are very, very serious human rights abuses and crimes that are taking place there. But the Taliban, they're denying this.
UNAMA also noted in its report that more than half of the deaths of former Afghan government members took place in the first 4 months after the Taliban seized control of the country. So that is a very significant acknowledgement on part of the United Nations, because those were the months when the Taliban were settling down and trying to establish their government and control over the country, the country which has seen war for many, many decades, and especially over the last 20 years, there have been so many groups fighting in Afghanistan. So during this volatile period of 4 or 5 months in the beginning, obviously, Taliban were not in control of the country. It was a totally different country. After 20 years, Taliban were in control in Afghanistan 20 years ago. But this time, when they took control of the country, it was totally a new situation for them. So they were really not in control of different provinces and their own security forces, which we call them security forces. But they were actually insurgents trained to fight a guerrilla war. So the Taliban were also a combination of different groups. So it's seems that initially certain groups within the Taliban were trying to assert their authority in certain areas and maybe settling scores with the members of the former Afghan security forces who were conducting operations against Taliban insurgents with the help of the U.S. and NATO forces at that time.
That was VOA Islamabad correspondent Ayaz Ghul speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis. 2 years after screening an internationally acclaimed documentary on the democracy movement in Hong Kong, director Kiwi Chow has been forced to complete a new movie with fresh financing after political concerns scared off some investors. Flora Bradley Watson with Reuters has the story.
Revolution of Our Times, a documentary about Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, won praise at the Cannes Film Festival 2 years ago. But now its acclaimed director, Kiwi Chow, says investors are scared to back any more of his projects. The same year the film came out, Hong Kong introduced a censorship law to bar films that might endanger national security. The measure followed the national security law Beijing imposed on the Asia Financial Hub in 2020. Chow spoke to Reuters about the pressures he says are now facing Hong Kong filmmakers, with many choosing to move abroad because of the increasingly restricted space at home.
You could say that actors at Hong Kong's film companies are filled with fear, which overshadows everything. In my case, this fear is particularly pronounced, but they may not experience it to the same extent with other directors. You could argue it's an individual situation, but it could also be seen as a broader experience of immense political pressure and intense self-censorship.
Chow scrambled to complete his new film, Say I Do to Me, after investors pulled 80% of its funding and the main actor withdrew. Although the film, a love story about a young woman on a journey of self-discovery, is far from political, Chow said investors told him they could not take the risk as they still had business with China. He also said the actors were pressured by their management not to work with him. In the end, about 40 to 50 supporters injected fresh funding so the film could be completed.
Many investors withdrew their support because of sensitivities surrounding my documentary, Revolution of Our Times. There's also many others who witnessed investors for Say I Do to Me pulling out, which made them unite to gather funding for my film. Despite the disappointing box office performance, I can't help but feel a sense of unease about those investors.
Since the censorship law was introduced in October 2021, a Reuters tally shows at least 21 movies and short films have had scenes cut or their release blocked by Hong Kong's Office for Film, Newspaper and Article Association. In an email statement, the office said it had processed about 5,000 applications for film classification since January 2021, denying approval for public exhibition to six of them. It declined to comment on individual films. Meanwhile, Culture Secretary Kevin Yeung has previously warned that government funding would not be allocated to film projects that might infringe upon the national security law.
That was Flora Bradley Watson with Reuters reporting. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a very wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
South Korea and Japan are capable and indispensable allies, and America's commitment to both countries is ironclad, declared President Joe Biden at the recent Trilateral Leaders Summit at Camp David. We've made history with the first ever standalone summit between the leaders of our three countries, as well as our commitment to meet together on the leader level annually, remarked President Biden. Our world stands at an inflection point, a point where we're called to lead in new ways, said President Biden.
First, we're elevating our trilateral defense collaboration to deliver an Indo-Pacific region that includes launching annual multi-domain military exercises, bringing our trilateral defense cooperation to an unprecedented levels. We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation.
All three nations reaffirmed their shared commitment to maintaining peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and addressing economic coercion. We're going to continue to counter threats from North Korea, said President Biden, including cryptocurrency money laundering to the tune of billions of dollars and potential arms transfers in support of Russia's brutal war against Ukraine. And together, stressed President Biden, we're going to stand up for international law, freedom of navigation, and the peaceful resolution of disputes in the South China Sea. The U.S., Japan, and South Korea also agreed to expand their economic cooperation, said President Biden.
We've committed to launch what we call a supply chain early warning system pilot, and which will alert our nations to disruptions of certain products and materials, like critical minerals or batteries, so we can get ahead of the issues that we've experienced during the pandemic.
And finally, our partnership is about building a better future for our people, said President Biden.
That's why we're deepening our cooperation on global health and launching a trilateral expert exchange and support of the U.S. Cancer Moonshot Initiative. In the United States, we are revolutionizing the way we do cancer research, and together, the three of us, I'm confident we can harness our shared spirit of innovation and end cancer as we know it.
In the months and years ahead, said President Biden, we're going to continue to seize those possibilities together, unwavering in our unity and unmatched in our resolve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.